Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 17th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, cooperative breeding, changing ocean currents, and the ivory-billed woodpecker. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
If your grandmother helped raise you, or an uncle, or even a family friend, then whether you know it or not, you were raised in a cooperative breeding system. In this week's Science, Andrew Russell and colleagues present their findings from studying the cooperative breeding system of the superb fairy wren, a small bird of southeastern Australia. While you may not be surprised to find out that cooperative breeding systems help the mother, life for the superb fairy wren chicks starts out perhaps a little harder. That's because the mothers invest less of their own resources into making the eggs, meaning lighter hatchlings, when they know there will be other adults around to help feed their chicks. I spoke to Russell from southeastern Australia, where he's doing research on another cooperative breeding system, and I began by asking him to describe some of the species that have cooperative breeding systems.
They're most famously known really in the social insects, the bees, ants, and wasps. They're also very common in mammals, for example, lions, elephants, and more recently, more famously, in a sense, meerkats. But also humans are cooperative breeders as well. It's common for us to have helping siblings. And, of course, the grandmother would be a classic example of a non-reproductive helper in a human system. And I actually then studied a bird species called superb fairy wren, which is a small 10-gram passerine bird from southeastern Australia.
Well, what did you and your team discover about the cooperative breeding systems of the superb fairy wren, if I'm saying that right?
Sure. So the principal finding was that in the superb fairy wren, females with helpers lay smaller eggs of lower nutritional content, so they have less lipid and less protein, and these eggs actually give rise to lighter chicks.
I can't imagine that helps the chicks very much.
No, you wouldn't think it would help the chicks much at all. It's actually quite a surprising result one might expect if an animal is breeding in a situation which is likely to be successful, in this case, in the presence of helpers, then you might expect them to actually increase their investment in eggs, but we actually found the reverse. And we also showed in a cross-fostering experiment, so we actually moved clutches of eggs between nests in eggs which were laid in a pair nest, so without helpers, and then moved to nests with helpers, we found that those chicks were very, very light. And that's because the mother was under-investing in those chicks with helpers at the egg stage. When we then moved those chicks to nests without helpers, they became very light. And most systems, most animals, light chick tends to mean a low survival chick. So, yes, you'd expect that it was quite a bad thing for the chicks.
Well, how well do those lighter birds from the smaller eggs of lower nutritional content do compared to the ones that are raised just by two parents? I imagine the helpers provide more food?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. So the helpers, when the mother is breeding in the presence of helpers, the offspring tend to receive about 20% more food than they do when chicks are reared without the benefit of having helpers. And so what might happen and what seems to happen is that helpers are effectively compensating for the mother's reduction in investment at the egg stage. And so the chicks actually end up the same weight, irrespective of whether they're reared by a pair alone or whether they're reared with a pair plus helpers.
Well, this doesn't seem to present any help to the chicks. What about help to the mother or to the society of birds in total?
Well, we think that one of the main benefits is actually to the mother. And so the mother, by reducing her investment at the egg stage, allows her to save resources for future breeding attempts. An alternative possibility is that the mother is somehow constrained from investing optimally in her clutch when she's got helpers because the helpers are consuming food on her territory. And we tested whether or not this was likely by increasing the size of broods to see how mothers could respond to increases in chick demand. And we find that the mothers increased their provisioning in large broods to the same extent when they're breeding by themselves or with their partner, as opposed to breeding in a group. And so it seems like the reduction in egg size was not caused by mothers being unable to provide enough resources in the eggs. And we believe that it was actually it's an adaptive, beneficial behavior by the mothers in order to attempt to save resources for the future. So in other words, that they're basically enhancing their own survival. And in fact, using 19 years of data from a neighboring population to our own one, we find that females who pair parents survive about 33% better from one year to the next if they've had helpers. And one of the reasons is likely to be because they reduce their investment at the egg stage and also actually the chick stage as well.
That's quite remarkable that a mother in the presence of more and more of these birds would be able to drop the content. Is this something that's common in cooperative breeding systems?
So I believe it will be common, but this is the first time it's been kind of looked at in a sense. It's not that people have looked and haven't found it, it's simply that people haven't looked before. It tends to be when one investigates helper effects in cooperative breeding systems, one would normally kind of correlate or look at the relationship between the number of helpers and chick survival or chick growth. And they haven't really considered that mothers might actually do something prior to the actual feeding of the nestlings. And so we believe actually this will be a common phenomenon. One of the reasons for that is because a very common observation in cooperative breeding systems is that mothers reduce their investment to the feeding of the offspring when they have helpers. And so it seems very likely to us that they should also reduce their investment at the egg stage as well. So yeah, we certainly believe it's going to be a general phenomenon. And indeed, I'll hopefully kind of be trying to test some of this kind of stuff in the future.
Is that what's next then, is to just look at more cooperative breeding systems in birds, or will you expand your search out to other species as well?
Well, I think I'll start with birds. I have another breeding system which I'm currently studying, which is called the chestnut crown babbler, which is an arid zone species in Australia. And it's a lot bigger than superfair wrens, but also more importantly, the breeding system is much more complicated. So they have up to 15 helpers at the nest, whereas the superfair wren seldom has more than two or three. And so to see whether or not a much more sophisticated, if you like, cooperative breeding system also shows similar results will lend to the generality of our findings. Whether or not this is also likely to occur in other species, I think that possibly depends. I think that any species which lays eggs, so potentially social insects and fish, might have this type of effect that we have shown. But mammals, I'm not too sure, because a female which invests less during the gestational period in mammal will still have to invest, you know, or compensate for that during the lactation phase. So whether or not mammals are also open to this finding or not will remain to be seen, but I hope some people will have a little look for it anyway.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome.
Andrew Russell is first author of a paper about the reduced egg investment in cooperatively breeding birds. Read more in the August 17th issue of Science.
The Congress of the United States does some funny things with respect to some scientific projects.
Donald Kennedy is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine.
It either likes them well enough to scoop them out of some priority line and promote them to special status, or it finds them, well, either stupid or silly and declines to give them money that their executive agency has already asked for. Well, we've had a long experience with both habits. The first has become so familiar that it has a pet name, PORC, short for pork barrel funding, and that received public notice first in the late 19th century when individual members would compete for rivers and harbors projects, for example. But it got to be a new trend in science projects, and it's particularly known in that area as earmarking after the practice of notching the ears of livestock to claim ownership. So an earmark project is one that a particular senator or congressman has put into a priority status because he or she thinks it's important to his or her constituents. In the development of a research agency's budget, then, a member will specify a line of support for a particular building or project. Now, at one time, this was just a cottage industry perfected by a few lone builders. In the Northwest, for example, Senators Magnuson and Mark Hatfield worked wonders for their medical schools. But the game changed all of a sudden at a time when Gerald Cassidy and Kenneth Schlossberg, a pair of well-known lobbyists, put together an organization that made pork barrel strategizing for science facilities a lobbyist's game. Their breakthrough was a special appropriation for Tufts University. Once that happened, Columbia, Catholic University, and others found their own way to pork. The subsequent history of this move of lobbying organizations into the business of pork barrel funding was chronicled by Bob Kaiser in an excellent series this spring in the Washington Post. Right now, pork barrel funding is probably at as high a level as it's ever been, and the new anti-lobbying provisions being considered now by the Congress haven't stopped it at all, and in fact, if anything, have caused it to be an item to brag about if you're a member or a senator. Well, on the other side of the coin, some members of Congress who are working to support projects that probably wouldn't have survived the competition of peer review, their colleagues are busy trying to defund others that already have passed competition. One thing members don't like is studying sex. Another is a study that sounds too much like social science. There are a lot of stories in this area. One year, a member objected strenuously to an NSF project that had the word ATM in the title. He wondered why we would spend some tax money studying automated tellers, but it turned out that the grant was actually for asynchronous transfer modes, ATMs, used in communications technologies. Well, in both these modes, whether adding pork barrel projects or delisting other projects that they don't like for some reason, Congress is acting to substitute its own judgment for priorities derived through tough competition in which expert judgments are taken carefully into account. Now, you can certainly make a case that if Congress wants to redistribute assistance for major science facilities for regional strength reasons or other kinds of reasons, it surely has the authority to do that. But if it does it, what it ought to do is state exactly what it's doing and why, and not take ad hoc bites out of a process that has served the nation very well and very fairly.
Donald Kennedy is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. You can read his full editorial, Pork and Punishment, in the August 17th issue of Science. One of the most powerful phenomena on Earth are the climate-changing effects of oceans. The most famous of these are known as El Niño and La Niña, the warming and cooling of the Pacific. In the Atlantic, meridional overturning circulation transports vast quantities of heat via the Gulf Stream and returns cold water to the equator, significantly warming North America and Europe. In a perspective in this week's Science, John Church writes on the analysis from a new system to monitor that circulation in the Atlantic. That analysis is presented in two research papers also in this week's issue. Church spoke with me from his home in Tasmania, Australia, and I began by asking him to describe that monitoring system.
There's been a remarkable new program which is monitoring the various components of the heat transport. Firstly, there's the northward flow of warm water in the Gulf Stream, which is measured by an undersea cable in the Straits of Florida. And then further to the east, there's a series of moorings which measure the northward flow of warm water on the upper slope of the western Atlantic. And then there's bottom pressure gauges on either side of the Atlantic Ocean, at the base of the slope on the west and the base of the slope on the east, and moorings which measure the density through the water column. So the combination of these bottom pressure gauges and the density measurements allows you to measure pressure differences across the North Atlantic throughout the water column. And it's these pressure differences which drive the net flow either north or south throughout the water column. And then you combine that with the cable measurements giving the transport of flow in Florida Strait itself and measurements of the wind to give the near surface wind-driven flow. And what's remarkable about this experiment, we have a very limited set of observations which were deployed by Cunningham and his colleagues. And they seem to be remarkably effective at measuring the total transport into the North Atlantic.
It's such a large ocean and such a few number of points. Did they have some previous tests that helped them place these particular buoys or markers?
I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a small array measuring the full width of the ocean. And what it really relies on is it's the pressure difference between the western boundary and the eastern boundary, which gives the north-south flow at that depth. And it's based on a very simple equation, geostrophic approximation, where the pressure difference is proportional to the transport at that depth. And so if you measure the pressure difference on either side of the ocean basin, then you can estimate what the transport will be.
Okay. Well, from the monitoring that's been done, what do we know so far?
Well, firstly, the overturning circulation, that's the northward flow and the southward flow, is surprisingly variable, much more variable than I would have expected. And my guess is actually much more variable than Cunningham and his colleagues expected when they deployed the array. Prior to deploying the array, there had been five transatlantic sections made with ships where they measured temperature and salinities and densities right across the North Atlantic. And from those measurements, they had calculated that the overturning circulation had slowed by about 30%, as I recall the number.
So that's from since...
That's over a period of decades, from 1957 when the first section was taken. The five sections suggested that the overturning had reduced by 30%. The observed variability covers the full range of those five observations over many decades. So the implication is that the suggested slowing of the thermohaline circulation might not be, in fact, a slowing. It may be merely that they've managed to measure the transport in these five sections at particular phases of the flow, and it might only be short-term variability that they measured over decades rather than a long-term trend. And we don't really know the answer to that at this stage.
So that would make it pretty difficult to spot a trend then and say what was happening for sure.
That's why it's now important that we maintain this array for years, and I think we need to maintain the array for decades. My understanding is the UK has just made a commitment to maintain the array for the next decade. Model calculations suggest that to detect a decrease in the overturning circulation, then you might need several decades of data.
Well, is that all that's needed, just more time, or would a larger array help speed up the trend spotting?
First and foremost, the most important issue is time. We need to maintain the array, maintain it at its full resolution. And I think during that process, they only have 1 year's data so far, during the process of analysis of the data, they will learn more about the overturning, more about how to improve their measurements. It might be that some small additions to the array, perhaps a little bit more detail around the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or going deeper into the ocean might assist, but I think the most important issue is more time.
Now, all of this is rather North American and European-centric. You're in Australia. Are there similar things happening in the southern oceans, and are there similar monitoring efforts going on?
Well, people have observed changes in the water properties of the overturning circulation in the Southern Ocean. So the very coldest water that's formed right near Antarctica, that's become quite a bit fresher in recent years, at least in the Australian sector. So people have observed changes in the properties, but measuring the overturning circulation or even measuring the transport of the Antarctic circumpolar current is a lot more difficult than it is in the North Atlantic. There's another phenomenon which is also important as part of this global circulation. That's the transport of warm water from the Pacific Ocean through the Indonesian archipelago into the Indian Ocean. That has been monitored recently for a short period of time. It's not an ongoing array like the North Atlantic is, but that's one where I believe we do know enough to design an ongoing system. Returning to the Southern Ocean, I think we need to learn quite a bit more before we have an operational system. It won't be as simple as in the North Atlantic. It'll probably rely on multiple measurements. and assimilating those measurements into models to fully understand the changes in circulation in the Southern Ocean.
Is that why it's more difficult, because there are a lot more patterns and things going on in the circulation?
Yes, it's because of that, because it's a lot, the circumpolar ocean, well, Southern Ocean is circumpolar in extent. It's not, you know, the North Atlantic is actually quite a small ocean basin compared to the vast South Pacific and Southern Ocean. So its size, its topographic complexity, it's a fact that it is circumpolar. There's a range of different issues, and it's also much less observed already than the North Atlantic.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Read John Church's perspective on Atlantic Ocean circulation, as well as two research papers on the topic, in the August 17th issue of Science. Also this week in Science, is conservation of forests and grasslands better than producing biofuel crops to curb carbon dioxide emissions? That's the question raised by Renton Rigolato and Dominic Spracklin in this week's Policy Forum. They argue that conserving and growing forests and grasslands would be 2 to 9 times more effective at reducing carbon emissions than using the same land for biofuel crops over a 30-year period. Read Carbon Mitigation by Biofuels or by Saving and Restoring Forests in the Policy Forum section of the August 17th issue of Science. What happened to the ivory-billed woodpecker? After a flurry of activity in 2005 among top-notched ornithologists, including peer-reviewed evidence that the bird was not extinct, 2 years later, no news. Science news writer Eric Stockstedt, who's also the managing editor of the journal's free online daily news site, Science Now, has been following the story. He reports in this week's magazine about what happened and ongoing efforts to find the bird. I asked him why the story was coming up now. Is there some new evidence?
No, there's no new evidence, and that's part of the story. And it's a pretty stark contrast from when the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker was first announced back in 2005.
Now, that's when Science published a paper on it about the discovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker. But that was after a peer review. So what evidence was there that the bird existed?
The team put it together with 3 different lines of evidence. They had multiple sightings by observers in the field, observers out there who repeatedly saw what they thought was an ivory-billed woodpecker. Another thing they did when they were searching for the bird was they put out what they called autonomous recording units. These were microphones that were on in various places in the field in the dawn and in the dusk, and they caught several recordings of what sounded like the diagnostic double knock. This is a signal that ivory-bills make, and also some Kent calls. Those are a cry that the ivory-billed makes.
Could you demonstrate what the double knock sounds like?
The double knock is a really quick rap-rap. It kind of goes, but it's even faster than that. And the first knock is louder than the second. The Kent call sounds sort of like a clarinet, and don't ask me to do a clarinet imitation.
Okay, I won't. I promise. And what was the third bit of evidence?
The other big line of evidence was a video that was caught. And it was a short video. The bird was way off in the distance. But the more they looked at it and analyzed it, the more reasons they saw to be convinced that it was an ivory-billed woodpecker.
So what does the video show, and why were the researchers convinced that it was the ivory-billed woodpecker?
They weren't at first. When they first saw this, they were a little disappointed, and that's because the bird is far away. It's just in a corner of the field of the video. There's only a glimpse of about 4 seconds of it as it flies away, and the bird wasn't even in focus. So it took a lot of analysis to make the case that it was an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Is that why the video is now in doubt? Somebody else analyzed it a different way?
There's a lot of analysis that's been done on this video, probably more than in bird history ever before. What happened after the video came out was some scientists looked at that and they weren't convinced. They did other analyses, and this starts to get really nitty-gritty, where the authors will say these pixels are part of the background, and the critics will say, no, they're part of the bird, and that from that you infer whether the bird's wings have a black trailing edge or a white trailing edge. So there's a lot of squinting that goes on. Another example of how difficult it is to work with this video is when the bird first appears in this video, the researchers were convinced that it's perched on the trunk, and then it takes off and flies. And because it was perched on the trunk, they went back and found the actual tree. They measured the tree, they put a model of a bird on, and then they could estimate how big it was. And that, to them, showed that this woodpecker was bigger than the pileated woodpecker, which are known to be in the woods and is the other top candidate for what the bird in the video was. If the bird turns out to be not perched, but actually already in flight, then you can't tell the size, and that line of evidence falls away.
Okay. So what's next then? Is it to go and find more evidence? And how successful has that been?
Well, what the critics want to see, what would really settle this debate, is a crystal clear photograph or video of the bird itself that shows all the diagnostic field marks, not just one or two. And what would be even better is a roost tree where you can go and repeatedly see the birds.
Now, Arkansas has conserved some 235,000 acres of the big woods where the researchers reported finding the bird. There have been a lot of searches since that reported discovery. Could you tell us about some of those efforts?
Well, the first thing that the Cornell team did was they mounted a really big follow-up expedition with lots of volunteers going through the same bayou where the bird had initially been seen the year before. So they put a lot of effort into that, and they came up empty. They couldn't find, they didn't even get more sightings of it. So their conclusion now is that the bird is no longer there, so that they've switched in the most recent field season to more of a mobile search, where they have a team of five people. They've scaled back. They have a team of five people going to various places in the southeast where the habitat is good, and if the birds still do persist, where you'd be most likely to see them. And that also, unfortunately, they didn't get anything that was really convincing.
Any extraordinary efforts using new technology or anything like that?
Yeah, they in addition to the recording devices, they've also put out cameras. These are devices that get mounted on or near trees where they see a possible-looking roost hole, and the cameras are motion-activated, so if something flies by, they'll take photos. Back in the days when they were really hot on the trail of this, they really pulled out all the stops. They had ultralight planes looking for the birds from the air. They had a videographer in a mobile lift, and he spent the better part of 6 months up there trying to catch the birds on film.
But no results?
Nothing yet. They're still at it, but there's no photo, there's no feather. A feather would be great, because you could get DNA evidence, but there's not that. Some searchers are trying to sample poop out of possible roost holes, but nothing convincing there either. So pretty much no bird right now.
So are we ready to say rest in peace to the ivory-billed woodpecker? Or are there scientists out there still searching or still determined to search?
There definitely are. The Cornell team says they're going to keep going at it for at least another year or two. There are other smaller teams in a couple of other states in the southeast. Now, how long funding is still available, that's another question. But even grants aside, I think there will probably always be people out in the swamps looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you coming down to talk to me about it.
My pleasure, Rob.
Science news writer Eric Stockstead writes about the ivory-billed woodpecker in the August 17th issue of Science. Also in Science this week, how have proteins evolved? Eric Ortlund and colleagues resurrected the structure of a 450 million-year-old protein using computational and biochemical methods. After synthesizing the gene coding for the inferred ancestral protein, they grew it in cultured cells. Then they analyzed its structure using X-ray crystallography. What they're finding are unique insights into how modern-day hormone receptors evolved. Read their paper, Crystal Structure of an Ancient Protein, Evolution by Conformational Epistasis, in the August 17th issue of Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Science Magazine's online editor, Stuart Wills, for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
Okay, so David, welcome back. What have you got for us today?
Well, Stuart, three cool stories. We'll talk about batteries that look like paper, squirrels that heat up their tails to fend off snakes, and finally, we'll talk about what explains the differences between chimps and humans.
Time-honored question, but before we get there, let's go to these paper-thin batteries.
Right, so for a long time, researchers have been trying to develop batteries that are thin and flexible. Obviously, you could imagine, Stuart, a lot of applications that smaller, very portable batteries would have, everything from watches to laptops to cell phones. But it's been really hard to combine all the elements that you need in a battery into something so thin and small. And just as a little bit of background, batteries have three main elements. They have an electrolyte solution, which is basically these positive and negative ions that move back and forth in the battery and sort of give it its charge. Electrodes on either side of the battery, those positive and negative electrodes that you're familiar with. And finally, they have what's called a separator membrane, which is where these positive and negative ions flow through. But as I said, it's been really hard to combine these, all these kind of bulky elements into something very small and thin. So researchers thought, well, let's give it a shot with cellulose, which is the material that's made to use paper.
Okay, so they want to make a battery out of paper.
They want to make a battery.
How do you do that?
So this is how they did it. They took cellulose and they dissolved it in this liquid salt solution. And once it was all dissolved, they added these microscopic carbon nanotubes. And they sort of mixed it all together, let it dry, and they peeled a film off the top. And this film looked like a piece of paper, but it functions as a battery. And the reason is because the solution that they dissolved the cellulose in is still present in small quantities in the paper. So that provides these electrolytes that pass back and forth. The nanotubes provide the electrodes. And finally, the paper itself is a separator membrane. So you've got all of these elements that are traditionally very bulky combined in this very thin piece of paper-like material.
Well, there are batteries and there are batteries, though. I mean, how well did this thing actually work?
Well, so far, they were able to use it to power a tiny little light bulb.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's not so bad. And what they also found is if they stack a bunch of these papers together, the more they stack them, the more energy they can get out of them. And one of the really nice things about this paper is because it's paper, a cellulose base, it's sort of made out of this biodegradable, non-toxic material. They think it could have a lot of applications for things like pacemakers and other types of battery-type devices you'd want to put in your body because it wouldn't have all of the sort of nasty stuff you normally associate with a typical battery.
So that sounds pretty cool. When are we going to actually start seeing these in our pacemakers and our cell phones and whatnot?
Well, experts say the challenge right now, they said it sounds really interesting, but one of the big challenges is finding a way to mass produce something like this. Obviously, you can't go around just, you know, with these vats of liquid battery and peeling film off them. So they've got to find a way to make this on a large scale, and they've probably got a few other technical hurdles to overcome, but a possible battery coming to you sometime in the future.
Well, that sounds great. Now we'll move on to these hot-tailed squirrels.
Right.
That sounds a bit suggestive, but let's go on.
Right. So there's this type of squirrel called the California ground squirrel. And actually, something I didn't know is that a lot of rodents can redistribute heat and blood flow throughout their body. So a lot of rodents are actually able to move blood around in their body, move blood to their tail, move it back to their body as a way of sort of regulating their temperature. And researchers knew that ground squirrels, one of the big enemies of ground squirrels are rattlesnakes, which not only attack the squirrels, but they attack their babies and eat their babies. So it's a bad scene. One of the things the squirrels use for defense is if the snake comes close, the squirrel rapidly vibrates its tail, sort of shakes its tail at the snake. And sometimes that works. Sometimes it scares the snake away.
The snake doesn't like that.
The snake doesn't like that. But the researchers that were studying this said, hey, you know, if squirrels can move their blood around, maybe they're doing something with the blood flow in their tail that maybe also is scaring the snake away. So they did this really neat experiment where they put a squirrel in one cage and a rattlesnake in another cage. And they put the cages right next to each other. And they filmed this encounter with infrared video. And what they saw was that when the squirrel saw the snakes, their tails lit up red under the infrared, which was proving that not only are the squirrels shaking their tails, but they're actually heating their tails up. And because snakes, rattlesnakes, have these sensory organs on their face that pick up infrared, the snakes are actually picking up this heat signature from the tail. So not only are they getting this rapidly vibrating tail, but they're actually seeing this sort of red, you know, in a sense, they're getting this sort of infrared beacon being waved at them.
Okay, so these squirrels start pumping heat into their tails when they see a snake.
Right.
But I mean, how do we know that's actually a defense mechanism for the squirrel?
Well, it's a good question. So what they did was they actually used a robotic squirrel.
Oh, well,
I'd love to
wonderful,
see what that looked
like. Yeah. Just this, what we need.
This robotic squirrel could actually, the researchers could actually control, this robotic squirrel had a heat tail, and the researchers could turn the tail on and off. And they found when they turned the heatable tail on in the robotic squirrel, the snakes were much more likely to sort of crouch into a more defensive position than when the tail was turned off. So it seems like this heated tail is really an important part of the squirrel's defense mechanism.
Okay, and finally, moving from tail-swinging squirrels to that age-old question, why are humans and chimps so different?
Right, and it's a great question because 30 years ago, researchers discovered that chimps and humans share 99% of their DNA. But I don't know about you, but I don't feel I look much like a chimp or act much like a chimp. So there's clearly a lot of differences between chimps and humans. But if there's so little genetic difference between us, what accounts for it? And researchers have been trying to figure this out for 30 years. So a team from Duke University did what was the first large genome scale survey of these regions of DNA called promoters.
Okay, so what are these promoters?
Promoters are these regions that are right before a gene, typically right before a gene. And what they do is they tell the gene, you know, whether to turn on or turn off. They also tell the gene how much protein to express. So they're not the gene itself, and they're not the protein itself, but they regulate the gene.
So they sort of kick the gene's activity into high gear?
Exactly, into high gear or sometimes into low gear. They basically just modulated its activity. So the researchers analyzed about 6,000 of these promoter regions between chimps and humans, and they found about 10% of them, there were big differences in the promoter regions between chimps and humans. And what was really interesting was a lot of these differences were related to genes involved in brain function and also in nutrition. And the brain function one is obvious. Obviously, we like to think that we're a little bit smarter than chimps, so it would make sense that we would have differences in genes that are involved in the regulation of genes involved in brain function.
Well, the brain function I can kind of understand, but what's going on with nutrition?
Well, so that's also an interesting story. And what it seems to be is there were dietary differences, and there are dietary differences between chimps and humans. And the researchers saw that about 100 of the genes they looked at, there were differences in the way humans were regulating some of their glucose metabolism, carbohydrate metabolism genes versus the way chimps were. And they don't have a lot of detailed data on it, but you can imagine that if these genes were affecting different ways humans were metabolizing, humans use more sugar to build bigger brains, and therefore differences that it would affect the diet between chimps and humans could also affect the brain function between chimps and humans.
David, fascinating stuff as usual. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on the site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the August 17th, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.